Alan, I was talking to the commanding officer of 16 Field Ambulance a few days ago, and he said that one of the most apprehensive moments or periods of his campaign was waiting for the Scots Guards to take Mount Tumbledown, because at that stage he felt that it was very much touch and go. I don't know whether you would agree with that, seeing it rather closer than he did, perhaps.
Yes, I suppose it was touch and go, but not from myself, really, as a layman in military terms, and being with such a smoothly functioning unit. I never felt it was touch and go as regards my own battalion, who I thought were very well led, and locally very strong. Of course, one didn't know what the overall picture was, and I always felt that if they ever got, that the Argentinians got air ascendancy over us and sunk more ships, in particular supply ships, then we would really be in big trouble, because we did have no resources other than what could be helicoptered to us at this stage at Bluff Cove that we could rely on. Witness what had happened to the ships at Fitzroy a few days before. I was not at all apprehensive about my unit. They were well led, very well led, and our commander, of course, won the DSO for the Tumbledown action. Was very good at listening to advice from all his officers, and gave a very good example of somebody who will make a strong plan by getting everyone to agree with the components of it from his particular point of view. He, of course, chose the best bits of what they had to suggest. So no doubts at all about the strength of my own particular unit. I felt the worst of the men there. Although, of course, it was all unknown what faced us. With the knowledge of hindsight, I, and no doubt the commander and all the other officers, would have done things in a different way to be more effective, save casualties, get those casualties treated more quickly and efficiently. But such is not war. One's very conscious of an unfolding part of one's life that is completely unknown, and no peeping around the corner will reveal what's going to happen to you. And at any moment, that life, one feels, might be cut short. So you go on very much from minute to minute, trying to make plans, but knowing that there are forces against you which you've got no control over. Anyway, a plan was made, and although we originally were due to move out on the 12th of June, because of a number of factors, in particular the guns running low on ammunition, because we begin to shell the other side at this stage. Indeed, prior to moving out on the 13th, desultory shelling took place in the Bluff Cove area, certainly on G Company's positions. Their trenches, they did have rounds land near them. And even some huge 155 rounds landed on the water at the other side of the cove, where some of our men were dug in, and where the on day two before we'd seen the Gurkhas move by on their walk towards the Stanley area. So we were beginning to have some experience of artillery fire before Bluff Cove, albeit at a distance. However, the plan was for us to move out on the 12th, but this couldn't be because our own guns, which were answering the Argentinian ones, were running low on ammunition. There were another number of other factors involved from the military point of view. So we didn't move, in fact, till the early morning of the 13th of June. Now, well remember us all being absolutely ready to move, and the helicopters coming in at first light and lifting us off and taking us, keeping very low between the hills, passing over the forward positions of the Welsh Guards and the Gurkhas and the gun line, which was at that stage was now ahead of us, of 4 Field Regiment. Towards the area of Mount Harriet and Stanley. Because prior to us moving forward, the Commando Brigade had taken Mount Harriet, and we were going to move up to moving along beside them and attack our objective of Tumbledown Mountain from, as it were, inside their flank. Originally, the plan was for us to attack in a completely hooking motion around the southern flank of, I think it was 4-2 Commando on Mount Harriet, and approach Mount William and Mount Tumbledown from the southwest aspect over a large area of open ground, which we later learnt was swept by fire from the Argentinian positions, who fully expected us to come this way. In fact, instead of coming round towards Stanley that way, our own operations officer and commanding officer and his company commanders and military advisors decided to, as it were, set up shop beside 42 Commando between Goat Ridge and Mount Harriet, consolidate there for half a day, and then move forward at night, attacking Mount Tumbledown from the west, moving east along the ridge of that feature, which directly leads on towards Stanley. This is rough going, and but this was felt to be the best approach to make with any likelihood of success and minimising casualties. Everything was done, I feel, to minimise casualties. All action took place at night. That's why there's so little photographic record of actual rounds landing and explosions and so on, because so much action took place at night. Certainly all the infantry fighting took place then. And so we moved off by helicopter and went into the forming up position, which was really at the west end of Goat Ridge. And the troops dug in there and dug their familiar, now familiar, peat sangers and ditches in which to hide up from shell fragments, because from the shelling which was beginning to arrive from the Stanley area, the shells were beginning to arrive in the area of Goat Ridge as we were digging in and landing and dispersing the ammunition and so on. And there we spent all day in what was at first sunshine, waiting for the evening when we knew that the companies would concentrate and begin to walk forward towards the tumble down area. At this stage, the RAP set up a sort of tent halfway along Goat Ridge, and at one stage we were in fact ahead of the rest of the battalion and certainly ahead of battle group headquarters. We only had the recce platoon in front of us when we set up the RAP, and it was novel to feel at the time that we were the furthest forward established setup in the British Army, and everyone else was behind us except our own reconnaissance platoon. It's a rather novel situation to be in, and ideal at the time, because when we took a few casualties at this stage, including a soldier who was pierced by a fragment from either a shell or a mortar, we were able to gather him in, deal with him in very much a textbook fashion, and bind up his wounds and cheer him up and get him on the helicopter ready for evacuation to surgery. And this was a very satisfactory situation for me to be in, as being responsible for medical preparations and in the battalion. Sadly, this situation was only temporary, because although I was ideally situated at this stage, when the battle, as it were, moved forward past me at night onto Tumbledown in all the cold and snow and fire, it became very much more difficult for me to do anything personally about the casualties that were occurring. And I'd like to come on to that now, on to the evening part, when as darkness fell, our own unit moved forward, G Company moved forward silently to take the west end of Tumbledown Mountain, where they thought there were machine gun positions, where in fact there turned out to be no Argentinians at all. And this gave us, I think, a false sense of security about how the evening was going to go, because as soon as they got into position, then the casualties took place in a part of the battlefield over which I had absolutely no control medically myself. This was a diversionary attack, which was sent in under command of Major Bethel, who was an ex-SAS officer. And he led a scratch force, really, of about platoon strength towards the Argentinian positions, as if he was going to attack them on the what was our original plan, in other words, to attack Tumbledown from the southwest along the open ground in the Port Harriet House approach area. And he came under very heavy fire from an entrenched company position of Argentinians, and two men were killed, and at least 65% of his attacking force were either killed or injured, including one sad thing. They were helping the wounded back from the position where the action took place, and people were helping other casualties, actually stood on mines, and some people lost parts of limbs, which was very sad. And I think, in terms of percentage of war wounds, his little force probably bore more wounds and injuries and deaths than any other part of the whole task force in proportion to their numbers. I think that it was something like 65% casualties. But they took their position and indeed saw off the Argentinians and killed large numbers of them and retreated, only because that really was the end of their operation. They were a diversionary attack and not really meant to get heavily involved with the enemy at all. They did so, I think, largely an accident. They were able to get so near to the dug-in Argentinians because they were undetected. The Argentinians were resting and many of them were asleep. And they, in fact, surfaced, as it were, surrounded by Argentinian bunkers and were forced into a life or death struggle with them, not through their choosing, but because they were allowed to approach so closely.
So I understand the Argentinians didn't really patrol offensively at all.
Well, I don't think they had enough warning systems. I mean, they should have picked up our chaps further out, and that would have been safer for them, I suppose. The fact they took so many casualties is because the Argentinians allowed them to penetrate so closely without them being detected. The casualties from that particular operation were not on my particular casualty evacuation chain and were dealt with, I think, by the RAP of either the Welsh Guards or the Commandos, I'm not quite sure which, but they were sent to Uganda from that RAP. Yes. And that really was the first casualties of the night as far as the main battalion action goes. After that action was over, the diversionary attack, and after G Company were in position, then the main action of the night took place, which was really the left and right flank companies of the Scots Guards, which had the unenviable task of taking the remaining, shall we say, 8/10 of Tumbledown Ridge, which was occupied by the, I think it was the 5th Marine Battalion of the Argentinian Army, who were all regular, as opposed to conscript troops. They'd been in position a couple of months on that ridge, and they'd dug themselves in to form actual underground little caves and trenches dug out of the stones on the stone runs that run down from Tumbledown Mountain, and were very heavily protected indeed from anything but a direct hit from a shell or a grenade. And they were very effective in stopping our men for most of that night, 13th, 14th of June. They held up the attack of left flank and inflicted heavy casualties on them. In particular, the first platoons which attacked the Argentinians from left flank were stopped by heavy fire, and they took killed and wounded at that stage. And any attempt to try and evacuate the wounded on behalf of the stretcher bearers that they had with them was very dangerous, because at this stage, stretcher bearers, when they attempted at all to put a casualty up and step up and walk off with him, attracted fire immediately themselves, both mortar and machine gun fire. And such was the accuracy of this on the stretcher-bearing parties that all conventional casualty evacuation effectively ceased. There was no such thing as casualty evacuation. It could not be done. It was dark, it was cold, there was snow. Intermittently, the moon would come up, would show people up. Illuminating shells, both from our own guns and the enemy's, would show up movement. There was small arms fire, which was terribly accurate. The enemy had night sight equipment. They had sustained fire, medium machine guns. They had the same machine guns as ourselves, the GBMG, firing on predetermined arcs of fire that swept all the approaches to Tumbledown. It eventually sealed off the troops that were hidden behind the rocks waiting to take the feature, and the paths of evacuation behind. Plus the fact, walking over those stones on that boggy ground at night, even without any equipment, you become tired after 100 yards. In daylight, at night, you're exhausted. Carrying a stretcher proved virtually impossible, and such stretcher parties as they were that tried to get through became broken up and disorganized, and very few casualties were evacuated off the mountain that night back to the RAP. I say few. In fact, when I looked at the figures later, about 20% of all our casualties of the wounded came through the RAP that night and the following morning. I would have liked to have seen more custom come back through my RAP, but it proved impossible to evacuate them, and one had to accept that. Very much, people that were hit by aimed Argentinian fire, if they took a bullet in the head or the chest or the abdomen, they probably died on the spot, looking at the wounds afterwards and the reports I've seen. If they had glancing blows or they were hit in the limbs, they not only survived, they lived. And as far as I am aware, the only man that died as a result of his wounds, who conceivably might have been saved, was one NCO who was hit in both legs and in the abdomen, usually a fatal combination, incidentally. He was hit in both thighs and in the abdomen, who couldn't be reached by anyone in the battalion until when they did reach him, he was dead, although he was known, I believe, to have lived for a short while. So anyone who did, in fact, not die as a result of initial wounding did live. The only sadness was that some of them had to wait so long in the cold and dark before eventually casualty evacuation took place. And here I come back to the effectiveness of having properly trained and, above all, effective medical orderlies of good character that we had in the form of both the Pipers and other medical orderlies in the four platoons, who were able to administer effective first aid at point of wounding prior to casualty evacuation. They were able to give morphine. Every NCO and officer had morphine and was able to give it and had instruction, felt confident to do it. And those casualties that should have had morphine, I've spoken to them since, and they did in fact get it. The fact that people get effective treatment is really all any doctor can ask. And my chagrin, really, at not being able to get my hands on more of the battalion that were injured, was tempered quite a lot by the knowing that the people did, in fact, get help from people at the point of injury. Eventually, although it was a hard battle, and there were great difficulties in getting effective artillery fire to fall on the protected positions of the Argentinians, eventually fire was brought down close to their positions, which must have shattered their morale quite a lot, along with the cold that they'd had to put up with for so long. And eventually they either stood, fought and were killed, or gave ground or became prisoners as left flank, as it were, got the kernel of the resistance on their middle part of Tumble Down Mountain and were able to reach the end of their objective. In the process, they lost not quite a lot of killed and wounded. And I think I pay tribute here to the young forward observation officers of the artillery that were involved, who were able to help the company commander and our own commanding officer get down effective fire from our own guns on the Argentinian positions to shake them up sufficiently to make them give ground, because there's no doubt about it that effective aimed and well-placed artillery fire will soften up the enemy so that even if you don't actually kill them, you make it possible for infantry to take their positions. This in fact was done, and as dawn was approaching, left flank secured all their objectives on Tumble Down, which is really the amounts to the over two-thirds of it, and the last third were taken by an attack which went after they achieved their objective from right flank, which was also resisted by entrenched small arms and machine gun fire supported by mortars and artillery. They were also opposed, and they took casualties right flank. And as dawn was breaking, they secured the whole of the tumble-down feature. Now, at this point, or shortly after it, I believe some of the enemy began to walk away their positions, and the rest of the brigade attack, which was following the taking of tumble-down, it was planned that the Gurkhas took Mount William and the Welsh Guards took Sapper Hill. They didn't, I believe, as far as I'm aware, have to fight for those features. The casualties and sacrifice made by the Scots Guards was really the main price that had to be paid for that night's victory. And from behind the rocks and from in the caverns and dugouts that the Argentinians had, they had to take, in hand-to-hand fighting, the various platoon positions that they came across as they moved along the feature from west to east. Bayonets were used on that night when grenades ran out. Grenades were very effective, I believe, in neutralising the enemy positions. They fired anti-tank weapons in attempt to both frighten and disturb the enemy. I'm not sure how effective they were. I think in the end it was men creeping from rock to rock and lobbing grenades and being prepared to close with the enemy that really took them out in that night.
How many casualties did you have that night?
We had altogether, during the whole of our action, 43 wounded, in the sense that they were wounded not by breaking their legs, but wounded by fragments or bullets. And 9 people were killed, including one attached Royal Engineer from the engineer support that we had that night. One man was missing in action too, who wasn't found for an unbelievable 7 weeks afterwards. And he, poor fellow, got cut off from one of the stretcher-bearing parties that I was talking about. And all sorts of theories were advanced to account for him getting separated from his battalion and not meeting up with them again for so long after the war ended. And his is really one of the most, I think, remarkable survival stories of modern times. How he survived, I think, is a very interesting story in itself. Why did he get separated? Why didn't he make contact? It was very, very wild country. There was nobody there once we'd moved off the next day after the battle, or after the next day or two. Now, those searches were made, laying up in an area where I don't think searches were made, in the Port Harriet house area. He was living in the attic of the house at night and went down to the coast by day and wasn't sure whether the war had ended or not and kept out of the way. And I think in the early stages of his separation, from what he's told me, undoubtedly he was suffering from exposure, which he somehow managed to survive from rather than succumb, when really he survived against all the odds. But he happily turned up later, 7 weeks as I say. In fact, we'd actually finished our period on the islands in garrison after the hostilities ended, and we're on our way back on the Norland, on our way back to Ascension Island, when he turned up and we had a signal while we were on the boat to say that he would have been found. And it really was an astonished experience to realise that this guardsman was alive, because we'd all given him up for dead long ago and had a memorial service to this effect. And his name appeared on a memorial. It was inscribed on a brass plate. It was put on a cross that was erected after the battle on Tumbledown Mountain. And it was difficult to take at first what possibly could have happened to this man. But I think, in some ways, resurrection is as difficult to come to terms with as bereavement is. And we all found it very difficult to come to terms with this. We all have now. I feel he was disorientated and suffering from exposure at the time, got cut off, miraculously escaped and survived. And he indeed is back with the battalion now, working effectively with them.
So there was no question of his having deserted, which was put in the press at one time?
In my mind, no. No. No, not at all. I mentioned this coping with 20% of casualties through the RAP, or about that figure. We also dealt with, in the RAP, wounded from people in our neighbourhood. At first light, attempts were made by myself and a colour sergeant to go forward with naval Sea King helicopters to where we knew the wounded had been concentrated, to pick them up and administer further first aid and evacuate them. Unfortunately, as we took off in the first Sea King helicopter, we were fired on, perhaps accidentally, by our own mortars, and pieces of the mortar debris that came out with the round actually clattered against the side of the helicopter. And there was an almighty explosion, which we thought was the end of everything, but somehow we kept flying and just rocked. And I think this must have had an unnerving effect on the crew involved, because although we flew forward to the edge of Goat Ridge onto the Goat Ridge tumble-down mountain, Mount Harriet area, he felt unable to advance further to the map reference that we'd been given where our wounded were. And so there was therefore delay in picking up our own wounded, which was regrettable. While we were there, some other incident happened, which I'd like to tell you about on the next tape.